From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When suicide bombers unknown blew up the United Nations headquarters in Iraq, the event offered cruel echoes of other fights against occupation in the Arab world. But it also revealed that not all terrorist bombings are treated alike in the Arab press. Peter Valenti, who teaches Near Eastern Civilization at New York University, says that Arab writers immediately and unanimously deplored the innocent loss of life.
The headline that we find in the United Arab Emirates Al Bayan newspaper on August 21st summed it up. It was a crime, and all the other Arabic newspapers across the board basically describe it in the same kind of terms. This was a crime against humanity. Innocents were killed, a waste of life.
Peter, is it fair to say that the reaction in the Arab press to this bombing is strikingly different from the reaction, for example, to the recent suicide bombing in a bus in Jerusalem that killed many Israeli civilians?
In general, I would say that's not true, though we don't see a lot of language deploring the bloodshed in the Jerusalem bombing. Strong language, which came out in Al-Quds' main editorial on August 21st, and that's a Palestinian paper, said that no one here thinks that the killing of children, mothers, or the elderly, as happened in the latest Jerusalem bombing, helps the cause of Palestinians for liberation. So what you see is deploring the death of innocents, such as children. However, most Arab writers do not spend a lot of time talking about the human dimension. They talk about the tactical dimension. The lead editorial in Jordan's Al-Ra'i, which very often represents Palestinian opinion, said, in conclusion, the bombing in Jerusalem brings no benefit.
One paper actually referred to the bombing in Jerusalem as a normal response to what it characterized as Israeli aggression.
Absolutely. This is once again in the lead editorial in Jordan's Al-Ra'i on August 21st. It says, despite the awful nature of the Jerusalem bombing, it unfortunately doesn't represent anything other than another, quote, normal attack in the series of many attacks that characterize the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Arab writers see it as just another step in a continuing downward spiral of tit-for-tat violence.
What happens when the Arab press, which the Arab world depends on not only for news and information, but for the molding of public opinion, parses these events mainly in terms of their tactical and political effectiveness?
I think that's a good question. I think this is a result, actually, of a deep-rooted cynicism in the Arab world. For many, many months, Arab writers have felt that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon of Israel can't be trusted, that he will try to break the truce. He will try to derail the roadmap. So focusing on the humanity of the bombing is actually a red herring. It doesn't get to the heart or the crux of the matter, which is the continued occupation. And the nature of occupation causes violence. I think the Arab press probably very well represents the Arab street.
After 9/11, there was a lot of hand-wringing in the West about the so-called root causes of al-Qaeda's violence and anger on the Arab street towards the West. And one of the conclusions was that the Western world was simply tone-deaf to the plight of the Arab and Muslim peoples around the world. If the Arab press does truly represent the Arab street and its way of thinking, and if the murder of innocents can be so bloodlessly analyzed as the latest event in the continuum of violence, will the Western mind ever really be sympathetic and understanding of the Arab mind, or are we doomed to play this to a long and violent draw?
The bottom line in the Arab world is that they feel that the United States government and the media are outright sympathetic to the Israeli side. They do not give a proper depiction to the dimension of the human tragedy that we see in Palestinian territories on a daily basis in all the Arabic press. The Arabic press, I think, sees itself as a counterbalance to the overwhelmingly pro-Israeli American media.
Does the Arab press as a whole understand that supporters of Israel in the United States view the situation as precisely the opposite, that the Western media are sympathetic to the Palestinian plight to the detriment of Israel and its position? Do they know that?
What many Arab writers point out if there was a semblance of balance or fairness between the two sides, meaning supporters of Israel and supporters of the Palestinian cause, if you will, or if there was fairness in the American media or the United States government, why is it that you very rarely see coverage of politicians in the United States making statements in support of the Palestinian cause? They feel it is unfair and biased and actually based on incomplete information on the historical nature of the Arab-Israeli conflict.
All right, Peter. Well, as always, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Peter Valenti teaches Near Eastern Studies at New York University and is a contributing editor to World Press Review.
For much of the summer, the Bush administration has been on the defensive about its sales techniques for the invasion of Iraq, specifically whether it exaggerated or invented evidence of weapons of mass destruction. A month ago, the notorious 16 incorrect words in the president's State of the Union speech were headlines around the world. But then, after the administration issued a series of denials, conflicting explanations, and semi-apologies, the issue largely evaporated. Except in the Washington Post.
The paper that expressed editorial sympathy for the war has nonetheless relentlessly pursued government misrepresentations of the Iraqi threat. This week on the op-ed page was a broadside from former Clinton administration arms control expert Peter Zimmerman, all but calling the president a liar. Earlier this month, the Post ran a 6,000-word deconstruction by Barton Gellman and Walter Pincus of the administration's case, documenting how intelligence on Saddam's nuclear ambitions was repeatedly overstated and taken out of context in the buildup to Operation Enduring Freedom. Joining me now is Leonard Downey, executive editor of The Washington Post. Len, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
I have to call your attention to a sentence in a piece in the New York Observer by Sridhar Papu. He said, "Since the end of the war, The Washington Post has launched a full-scale attack against the Bush administration and the evidence supporting the war in Iraq." Is this an attack? Is it a crusade?
No, it's not. It's what we always do. It's what we've done with previous administrations. If you recall the attack on the chemical plant in Sudan by the Clinton administration, when questions were raised about the reasons for doing that, we examined that just as closely. That was a different administration, a different place.
All right. Let's just say then that the pressure on the administration grows from the Washington Post and elsewhere, that there were more revelations, that let's even just imagine that there's evidence that at very high levels there has been collusion to fabricate or at least delicately assemble the facts that led to the Bush administration's march to war. Let's just imagine that. There will be, I think, inevitably, comparisons to Watergate, and the Washington Post will get a lot of credit for that, should it come to pass. You haven't had your Watergate yet in your watch at the Washington Post. Do you think this has the potential to be your Watergate?
Well, first of all, I'm afraid I have to reject the supposition that I'm seeking a Watergate. That's not what we're doing here. We're not seeking any particular outcomes, and I don't necessarily expect any cataclysmic outcomes from this reporting. We're existing in a very complicated time right now. The threat of terrorism is ongoing. The occupation of Iraq is going to last a long time and be very difficult. You know, the state of the domestic economy is in question. I think we're in very uncertain waters politically here. And so the fate of this administration in the next election and thereafter will depend on lots of factors. And this may or may not turn out to be one of them. But it's not our intention in publishing it. That's not what we're seeking here.
I understand, and I'm not suggesting in any way that you're either cooking it up or hyping it or trying to put your imprimatur on the Washington Post or find your place in history or any of the above. However, every journalist has a sense of whether a story is going to be a big one or a little one, whether it's going to be transitory or ongoing. Well, you know, there's some sort of internal barometer. And I'm just wondering if your personal Len Downey barometric pressure is going up or down on this story.
Right. That's a question I can understand and respond to. And the answer, I'm afraid, however, is that I don't know at this stage, because I don't know how much the American public is engaged in these questions of the rationale for the war. If you look at the polling, the American public, as always, is, I think, more sophisticated than we in the media give it credit for. And, you know, they never put too much stock in a lot of the rationale for going to war in the first place, except for the fact that they didn't like Saddam Hussein, and they're glad that he's been defeated, and they're glad that it's happened at a relative low cost of American lives, and they seem to be watching the occupation in the same way by judging how long is this going to take, how much is it going to cost, how dangerous is it going to be for the troops that we have there, and how long are their fathers and mothers and brothers and sisters and husbands and wives going to have to stay over there. My gut feeling, since that's what you asked about, is that those factors will matter more in how the public judges the administration's conduct of this war than the technicalities of how well the administration made its case.
There are many reporters, including your White House correspondent, Dana Milbank, have complained almost since day one about access to the Bush administration, a White House that has been almost in the lockdown mode from day one. I'm just curious, has the tenacity of your reporting on this issue caused you any problems in the ordinary course of covering the White House on other matters, routine and otherwise?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I am aware that some of the officials whose utterances were closely examined in that article aren't happy about the way in which the article characterized them, and they've made that clear to us. But in the larger scheme of things, I think the pattern that we're seeing with this administration's relationship with the media is that they came here a close-knit group, almost entirely intact from Texas, and added on people like, say, Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, who also believed with them in the discipline of message, and they had unusual success for a long time in enforcing that. I think as time goes by, under the strains of both domestic and foreign challenges, and as the administration itself begins to change internally, the departure of Karen Hughes to Texas, for example, there are feuds going on within the administration, there are differences of views. We're beginning to see the kind of seams, if you will, in their protective armor, and that opens it up to more fact-finding by the media.
Not chaos yet in the White House.
No, no. I think that the disintegration of the Clinton administration in its final years gave the media unusual opportunities within an administration that we had not seen for some time before then and probably won't see for some time in the future.
All right. Well, Len Downey, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Len Downey is executive editor of The Washington Post, which ran a 6,000-word piece poking holes in the administration's explanation of Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons capabilities.
Coming up, a fair and balanced look at the Al Franken Fox News dispute and what's up with CNN.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Friday, oral arguments were heard in Fox News' recently announced suit against left-wing humorist Al Franken. The news outlet claims that he's infringing on their trademarked slogan with the title of his new book, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right. Well, a couple of weeks ago, we got a letter from Paul Janisch, an associate professor at Quinnipiac University. He wrote, I use the terms fair and balanced in my teaching materials. Will Fox News Channel come after me for trademark infringement? Since we poke a little fun at Fox every now and then, we were wondering if we should be a little nervous ourselves. So we put in a call to Frank Dean, a lawyer who teaches a course in media law at Syracuse University. Frank, welcome to OTM.
Pleasure to be here.
So our letter writer was being obviously a bit glib, but it is important to note that trademarks of common words or phrases don't affect everyday usage.
Well, that's correct. They affect commercial uses. And that's what Fox News has stated here, that because Al Franken's making a commercial use of the term fair and balanced in his book, therefore it violates the copyright, which is absurd, but that's the allegation.
Well, you can trademark, say, Apple for a computer or Let's Roll for a charity, right?
Sure you can, but you can't trademark any phrase under the sun. This particular phrase, fair and balanced, was clearly intended by Fox News to be descriptive of the service that it offers. And descriptive trademarks really shouldn't be registered. One interesting question is how this trademark got registered in the first place.
But the trademark applies only to, quote, entertainment services in the nature of production and distribution of televised news programs anyway. So the fact that Al Franken uses it as part of a title of a book shouldn't obtain anyway, right?
Well, that's right. You know, the first hurdle is whether the thing should have been registered in the first place. Now that it is registered, you're absolutely right that it's registered to apply to a class of services. And that's not what Mr. Franken did, obviously. So Fox News had to go to a second line of argument, which is as follows. Some trademarks are so famous and so pervasive that they get additional protection. An example of this might be Xerox. If someone were allowed to use Xerox even in another context as applied to different goods and services, it would blur the trademark and its value and therefore should be prohibited.
So you think they have a bad case on a variety of levels?
I think they have pretty much of a zero case. But let me talk about the one case in which this most recently came up. A fella had a little lingerie shop called Victor's Little Secret and was sued by Victoria's Secret. And they said, you're blurring our famous trademark. And the Supreme Court there ruled that in order to prevail in a case for blurring or tarnishment of a trademark, that you'd have to show not only that your mark is famous, but that you suffered actual economic injury. So Fox News here would have to have some way of showing that they're being economically hurt because Al Franken used fair and balanced in the title of his book. I don't think so. In fact, I don't even think most of the people who watch Fox News are going to go out there and buy Al Franken's book and vice versa. So economic injury is going to be very hard to show.
However, economic benefit seems to be manifest, at least for Al Franken. I understand that on the Amazon bestseller list, it was hovering in the 400s until Fox announced the lawsuit, and then it shot up to number one. So that's not bad for a book that only comes out in September.
Yeah, well, let me tell you something. Roger Ailes is a really smart guy. He knows that no matter how much beneficial publicity this results in for Al Franken, it's going to result in a lot of beneficial publicity for Fox News. It's going to keep people talking about Fox News and about fair and balanced. So both these guys are going to be laughing all the way to the bank when this is over.
Well, you say that it's fundamentally a nuisance suit or perhaps a PR suit, but you also raise the point that Al Franken could have a good point in his defense by saying that Fox would have to justify the use of the phrase fair and balanced. And could Al Franken actually challenge them for false advertising?
No court of law is going to want to make a subjective judgment over whether this network is really fair and balanced. But I think it does raise another interesting question, which is that Mr. Franken, or for that matter, one of Fox News' competitors, could go back to the trademark office and say, you know, you ought to cancel this trademark. It never should have been granted in the first place because you can't register a trademark in fair and balanced news any more than I should be able to register a trademark in cold to describe the beer that I sell. By the way, if Fox really didn't intend fair and balanced to be descriptive of its services, then they can make the case that it was intentionally misdescriptive, and it shouldn't be registered for that reason either. But no, this is a great example of legal gamesmanship, or really the use of the legal system to achieve perhaps some very important but really unrelated ends.
Well, thanks very much.
I enjoyed it immensely. Thanks, Brooke.
Frank Dean is an attorney for Smith, Dornan, and Shea and a visiting professor of communications at Syracuse University. When war is raging, or 50 million people are plunged into darkness, CNN is at its best, delivering up-to-the-minute news for an eager audience. In the absence of crisis or mayhem, however, the mission of 24-hour cable news becomes less clear and the ratings challenges more daunting. Fox News Channel has found one solution, a hybrid of news and incendiary talk radio-style opinion.
And CNN has tinkered along populist lines, too, with star anchors, crossfire pyrotechnics, and tabloidy topics, but with a palpable sense of unease and not much success. Now, with the rise of CNN veteran Jim Walton to the top job, the network is renewing its commitment to the old values of hard work covering news. The New Republic's Jason Zengerle visited the CNN Center in Atlanta, otherwise known as the Biosphere, and wrote for the New York Times Magazine about the network's ongoing identity crisis. Jason, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
How would you characterize, now that you've spent some time in the Biosphere, CNN's notion of what its relationship is with its competitor Fox News Channel?
It's really actually quite difficult to get anyone at CNN on the record to say the word Fox. They go out of their way to pretend it's not there. They refer to one of their competitors usually when they're talking about Fox. But I think what Walton's trying to do is make it clear inside the Biosphere and inside all the bureaus that CNN is a different beast. Fox is about opinion and commentary. CNN is largely about presenting the news in a serious, objective way. And that's not to say that it's going to be like the old CNN, just which was a pretty straightforward, almost bare-bones approach, almost ascetic to presenting the news. Ted Turner had this notion that the news is the star. Walton doesn't think that. Walton wants to make sure that the people presenting the news are attractive and engaging, you know, that he actually has stars delivering the news. But at the same time, he wants those stars to stick to the news and not get into opinion or tabloidy things.
One of the most interesting aspects of your piece in the New York Times Magazine concerned the attempt under the previous news management regime at CNN to build ratings. The current boss is Jim Walton, but preceding him was Walter Isaacson, who had been there for about 5 minutes before he brought in Connie Chung. Tell me about the Connie Chung Tonight program.
Well, on the plus side for CNN, Connie Chung really grew the ratings in that 8 p.m. time slot. On the downside, her show was, as some people there would put it, off-brand. It was very tabloidy. It frequently had stories about kidnappers or pedophiles. She also, I think she hadn't done live TV in a while, and she was a bit rusty. So while the show garnered pretty decent ratings inside CNN, it became a real flashpoint for a lot of people's grievances.
So about 5 minutes after Walton took over, he canceled Connie Chung, and she went off and left the company. Your piece notes that this made Walton a hero at CNN. Tell me about Jim Walton and his journalistic history.
Well, Walton is a CNN lifer. Right after he graduated from college in 1981, he went to the network. He took an entry-level job. Some of his duties included operating a teleprompter, and he's been there for 22 years. He's not a flashy guy at all. He's not really even very well known outside the building. Walter Isaacson, obviously, before he came to CNN, he'd been the managing editor of Time. Since he's left, he's written a biography of Ben Franklin. Those aren't things that Jim Walton's going to do. But the rank and file there, I think, just implicitly trust him in a way that they don't trust people who come from outside the company. CNN is a very insular culture.
On the other side of the equation, though, the people who came in, like Walter Isaacson, and most particularly Jamie Kellner, the Hollywood programming genius who was actually Walter Isaacson's boss during Isaacson's regime, believed that those in the Biosphere had been in the Biosphere too long and were just naive about what it took to generate an audience. Truth in that view?
Yes. I mean, when CNN was created, it was one of a kind. Kellner and Isaacson, I think, came in and they probably overreached in a few instances. They made some miscalculations, but the general thrust of what they were trying to do was probably necessary for CNN in the new competitive environment of cable news.
CNN is owned by AOL Time Warner. Do you think AOL Time Warner will be content to maintain CNN's news values if they understand that they will never be able to compete with Fox News Channel? Or will there be pressure on Jim Walton, as there was on Walter Isaacson, to make changes at the margins that will deprive CNN of its soul?
Well, there are two competitions going on. There's a ratings competition and there's a money competition. And right now, CNN is getting crushed in the ratings competition, but they're actually winning the money competition. Now, CNN's analysis for why that's happening is they think that advertisers will pay a premium to advertise on CNN because it's a classier environment, because of its news environment. There are people in the advertising community who say that's true, but there are other people who say that advertising dollars will follow the ratings. And Fox has only been beating CNN for about a year and a half now. And in that year and a half, you've seen them catch up with CNN in the advertising department. If Fox starts making more money than CNN, I think you'll then see AOL Time Warner start saying to CNN, why do we need to have this huge news operation? But for the moment, all Walton needs to do is make more money than Fox, and AOL Time Warner will be happy.
Well, Jason, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Jason Zengerle is an associate editor for The New Republic and a contributor to The New York Times Magazine. 40 years ago this week, 250,000 people descended on Washington, D.C. to make their common grievances known. It wasn't the first time, and it certainly wouldn't be the last, that Americans exercised their right to assemble on the doorstep of the nation's lawmakers. But never before had the media focused to such a degree on mass protest. And no demonstration since the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom has been so repackaged and reproduced. Historian Lucy Barber is the author of Marching on Washington, The Forging of an American Tradition, and she joins me now from that city of protest. Lucy, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Bob. Pleasure to be here.
There is a single moment that is etched in all of our consciousnesses from the 1963 March on Washington. Let's listen to it.
I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
Well, I guess you agree that that's the moment from the March on Washington that we most remember. My first question is, why? Is it a fair representation of what the march was supposed to be all about?
I think we remember it the most because it got played the most. Both since then, it shows up on commercials, it shows up in clips every year when they do the annual story on the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. But I think even more critically, it started to be what the march became on television very quickly. So that if you see the live coverage, they're of course covering every part of the march, all the controversies, all the different speakers, all the different voices. But by the time they start distilling it down, they've already started to focus down onto King. He was the celebrity. They set it up so he was the last speaker. And rhetorically, he was the most accomplished.
Apart from the inherent theatricality of this great oration by Dr. King, do you think there is a reason that the networks chose to focus on this speech, which was decidedly non-confrontational, as opposed to the fairly confrontational message that the organizers intended, which was to demand, not request, but demand legislation immediately to create equity for blacks and other minorities in the United States?
Those who have said be patient and wait, we must say that we cannot be patient. We do not want our freedom gradually, but we want to be free now.
That was John Lewis, and he didn't sound like he was in the mood for compromise or dilatory action on the part of the United States government. We seldom hear that cut of tape.
No, and that's because he was demanding now. And yet King said the same thing. He just said it in the first part of the speech. And that part of the speech was not as dreamful, was not as optimistic of a future that would be different. And the media turned from the story of the demands to the story of the dream. Mostly, I think, on television. When you look at the press coverage, it's much more complete.
There was an interesting observation made by one of the reporters reporting live from the scene, very ironic in retrospect. Let's listen to that.
You notice there is no noise. This is a very, very orderly procession, straggling, confused. One of the most interesting things about it is that the people are doing the marching. There are very few people actually watching. There are a lot of police lined up at about 6-foot intervals along either side.
And well, maybe Washingtonians didn't show up in person, but the reporter was quite wrong. The march was watched worldwide. Tell us about the breadth of the coverage.
Well, it was covered live on CBS all day, and then the other networks came in and picked it up. At the same time, it was being broadcast to Europe by the new satellite systems that had just gone up just a few years before. And so it didn't have the immediate spectators that previous marches had so depended on. But it had this new set of spectators because there was that live coverage of it.
So in a very Marshall McLuhan-esque way, the medium had actually become the message received loud and clear around the world.
Yeah, and that, of course, raised concerns for some people, because even if you started to have the march compressed down to the I Have a Dream speech, in other ways, they had the march showing people saying, we want freedom now. We want a civil rights bill now, in red, white, and blue signs. And I think people picked up on that dichotomy, and people at the time wondered how that was going to affect the next stages of the civil rights movement.
If the coverage and the focus, for example, on Dr. King's speech skewed the meaning of the March on Washington, did it also somehow ultimately transcend the relatively modest immediate goals of the sponsors? Did the media enable the March on Washington to be actually bigger than anybody among the organizers had ever imagined?
I think they actually had really high ambitions from the beginning. One of the things you notice from almost the day one that they start calling for this march is that it's going to be historic. That's the refrain during the day. And then Kennedy calls it a part of American history. So what happens to the march, in a way, is it becomes almost more important for the history of American democratic struggles than it does for the complicated battles of the civil rights movement. But even as it became this model, of course, it was kind of hard for other social movements to match that day, partly because it's been so celebrated and edited since. For any other march, the media seems to end up saying, well, they didn't get as many people as the Civil Rights March in 63, or there was no rhetoric that was as good as Dr. King, or the crowd didn't seem as united. And that seems to give the media, at least, a way to distance themselves from some very powerful collective gatherings in Washington and elsewhere.
All right. Well, Lucy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob, for having me.
Lucy Barber, a historian at the California State Archives, is author of Marching on Washington, The Forging of an American Political Tradition.
Coming up, bogus trend spotting and why we love the TV crossover.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with this week's OTM Trend. In Tennessee, a home gardener named Rita is using a syringe to inject her zucchini with an organic pesticide. Bob, an Illinois aquarium culturalist, feeds his water fleas by syringe-injecting pureed zucchini into a 55-gallon drum. And a mom named Christy tells her friends on BabyCradle.com that she uses the same technique to feed strained zucchini to her spoon-averse baby son. Yes, in one of the hottest trends of the new millennium, everywhere you turn nowadays, zucchini and medical syringes are turning up together. You know, or not. I actually found those examples by doing an internet search for the random combination of zucchini and syringe. The results were almost exclusively about organic gardening,
But with a little selective editing, by the generally accepted practices of journalism, the zucchini syringe marriage constitutes a bona fide trend.
It sounds like a cliche to say three things makes a trend, but that really is kind of the rule of thumb we look for.
Kim Willis is a features editor at USA Today, which has divined trends in premarital cohabitation, sport fishing, raw food diets, teen oral sex, men wearing engagement rings, and thousands of other phenomena, real and hyped, for which the rule of three is the guiding principle, if not the actual definition.
We don't think, great, we found three examples, we can write a story. It's more, if we can't find three examples, this is really a trend.
Well, good for them. But of course, in a universe in which trillions of events occur in each fraction of a second, three favorable examples, or four or 4,000, don't necessarily mean anything. Yet journalists persist in extrapolating dubious trends from isolated anecdotes, demonstrating not a trend, but an immutable constant, the media's ongoing love affair with the fallacy of favorable enumeration. In fact, never mind the rule of three, journalism is the only place in the physical universe where one point can determine a line. Jessica Lustig is editor of Details magazine.
What we are trying to do is be entertaining and be timely and respond to things that we're sort of picking up in the culture. And you're right, there's something a bit made up about them. And what that is taking some scrap of data or information from the news or from cultural mood and then carrying it farther.
So, for instance, when somebody at Details noticed a gigantic Calvin Klein billboard prominently featuring in sharp, skimpy underwear relief, a man's bulging genitalia.
We ran a piece wondering if this was going to provoke a kind of anxiety in men, a sort of self-consciousness that's been more associated with women till now and has resulted in all sorts of industries like, say, the Wonder Bra to respond to that anxiety.
So what happens when a magazine like Details, ostensibly the periodical of record for all that is hip and happening, decides that the world is ready for Wonder Pants? Well, one thing that happens is that the alleged trend may soon be embraced uncritically by other news organizations, who do their trend spotting not in the wild, but in the pages of other publications, creating a lost in the funhouse parallel universe of media-validated unreality. USA Today's Kim Willis worries about that all the time.
Because if In Style has written about it, and the Wall Street Journal has written about it, and then USA Today has written about it, then it's this huge trend and everyone in America is doing it. But often, you know, what's happening is one paper or magazine is seeing the other one's story and then saying, well, gee, maybe we should check this out.
Oddly, media hype isn't especially influential in the proliferation of genuine trends, according to author Malcolm Gladwell.
I think mass media can induce very transitory, ephemeral changes. But if you want to generate real fundamental transformation of behavior, speech, thought, anything like that, I think you need to have the kind of face-to-face, person-to-person, true viral transmission.
Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, investigates that moment of critical mass when an extremely localized fashion or fad begins behaving like a communicable disease, infecting the general population. This, he says, happens independently of the media. What genuine trends and bogus trends do have in common, though, is their provenance in a tiny percentage of the population.
You read those stories, and when they proclaim a broad trend, you understand that what they're saying is that this is the kind of thing that those of us who would like to emulate the lifestyles of the approximately 1,000 people who we're describing in the story, you know, this is what they're doing, and do with that information as you will.
The hip-obsessed, in other words, writing about the truly hip for the wannabes of hipness. Journalist Michelle Goldberg has played the game herself.
As a freelance writer, I understand why writers create these stories, especially people who aren't staff writers, because it's so easy to sell. And so if you need to make a paycheck, you need to just, it's kind of like playing that game Concentration or something. You need to find three matching things and put them together, and you kind of create the narrative around that.
But Goldberg also sees the dangers. Apart from the obvious risk of misrepresenting reality, I mean, are men really rushing to wear engagement rings? There's the more pernicious danger of ignoring significant trends by obsessing on superficial, trivial ones. This was brought home to her while surveying major newspapers for their economic coverage in the wake of 9/11.
I was absolutely stunned. One of the first cover stories about this economic mess in the New York Times Magazine is about the future of Gucci. Meanwhile, you have to dig to see that homelessness is skyrocketing in this country. You see proportionally much, much, much less feature coverage of how people are dealing with, say, losing a job of 30 years and finding themselves on food stamps than you do with the shattered dreams of a 24-year-old who can no longer get a $50,000 a year job for making flash animations.
Maybe that's because trend spotters are perpetually in search of something hot. And there is nothing hot about lost service industry jobs. Unfortunately, there is a fundamental disconnect between serious exploration of societal problems and the glib pursuit of hotness. The pitiful fact is, it's hard for many publications to consider the unemployed, for instance, unless they're kneeling in their backyards, tending to their tiny home gardens, shooting up their zucchinis.
Speaking of trends, media outlets ranging from Reuters to the New York Times have declared this to be the gay summer of aught-three. Bill Powers wrote about the gay summer phenomenon in his National Journal column this month, and he joins us from his home in Cape Cod to discuss it. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brooke. Good to be here.
So we saw the wave gathering much earlier this summer when the Times used the term metrosexual. I think it was used first here last year by Salon, and of course it's been used quite a lot abroad, and it refers to straight urban men who embrace their feminine sides by getting manicures and dyeing their hair and so on. But you suggest that the metrosexual is not so much a cultural phenomenon as a media creation.
Yes, well, it had the feeling to me from the beginning of a kind of a synthetic trend that the media were running with because it coincided nicely or helped fire up a larger story, which is the gay marriage, gay rights story that we've been following. Media people realized that they have to have a pop culture angle to make a political story fly, even if it's a very important one like the gay rights one.
So you're saying that we wouldn't have had as much coverage of the legalization of gay marriage in Canada, the Supreme Court striking down anti-sodomy laws, and the ordination of a gay bishop and so on, if it weren't for the fact that boy meets boy and queer eye for the straight guy exist?
Exactly. I mean, it's sort of a cynical point, but I meant it seriously, that this pop culture angle has become crucial in selling every major story.
You write that when the media are writing a giant story like this one, they can be relied on to throw caution to the wind and start buying into pure silliness. What do you mean by that?
Well, there was one example I gave. I've seen a few of these, but the one main one that I used is a New York Times health columnist wrote a column about new research data, which she said showed that gay parents are not just as good as straight parents, but actually better. They had to work harder to have them, and they're more aware of diversity issues than straights are. Now, when you look at the broad variety of people who could be parents, both straight and gay, and in my opinion, when you acknowledge the fact that it all depends on the individual, it's not about sexuality, I thought her buying into this claim of this data was kind of irresponsible, that at the very least, if she's going to present this study as a columnist, she should have a somewhat skeptical eye about it. But she just presented it virtually as fact. And to me, this was an example of taking a trend and really gilding the lily, going overboard and buying into questionable data and putting it in the newspaper.
Bill, do you notice as we head towards Labor Day that there seems to be something of a backlash? There was a Gallup poll recently that showed a big drop in the percentage of Americans who support legalized homosexual relations. That's actually bucking the trend of increasing percentages of Americans who seem to have no problem with it.
Yeah, it was very surprising. And in fact, there has been some coverage of this question, news stories that basically asked how, in a time where we're paying so much attention to gay people and the rights questions and so forth, and where they seem to be more accepted in pop culture, could there be this downward trend of acceptance of gay marriage? I mean, literally, that Gallup poll showed that fewer people support gay marriage now than did, I think it was even 6 months ago or a year ago. I mean, a very recent drop. But I basically wondered if maybe the extent to which we hype a story like this with all these pop culture framings and allusions and all this kind of data that swirls around might turn off the public. And they might develop some skepticism and say, wait a minute, the media are kind of stuffing this down our throats here. We need a break.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Bill Powers is a columnist for the National Journal, and he'll be no doubt relieved to hear that after much deliberation this week, we've decided not to follow the lead of Fox and sue him for calling his column on the media.
Last weekend's surprise box office favorite was Freddy vs. Jason, which took in more than $36 million despite the blackout. We're still waiting to see if the success of linking two movie franchises sparks a real trend, say Austin Powers teaming up with James Bond or Shaft hunting down Blackula. But as NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, the appeal of the crossover is something that TV producers have long understood.
The first thing Tom Holbrook would have you know is that a crossover is not the same thing as a spin-off. A spin-off is when a popular character from one TV show gets his or her own show. Good Times was a spin-off of Maude, which was a spin-off of All in the Family. A crossover, says Holbrook, is something altogether different.
It's not necessarily a character from one show leaving to start another show. It's a character from one show paying a little visit to another show.
For instance, he says the character of Kramer on Seinfeld once showed up as Murphy Brown's secretary. The character of Chandler on Friends appeared on Caroline in the City. And Bobby from The Practice ran into Ally McBeal, literally.
Are you all right? Are you okay? I wasn't looking where I was going.
It's okay.
Bobby Donnell.
Ally Donnell. McBeal.
A few years ago, Holbrook was working at a TV station in Ohio. His job entailed watching lots of old reruns. And he came to realize just how venerable a tradition the crossover is in television. Charlie's Angels did a crossover with The Love Boat. Alice did a crossover with The Dukes of Hazzard. There was even an animated crossover between Bewitched and The Flintstones.
Bye. Have fun.
Hi. We're your new neighbors. I'm Wilma Flintstone, and this is Betty Rubble.
Nice to meet you. I'm Samantha, and that's my husband, Darren.
In fact, there were crossovers way back in the days before color TV. Private Secretary once did a crossover with the Lucy Desi Comedy Hour, which crossed over with Make Room for Daddy, which crossed over with the Dick Van Dyke Show. Some of the best television writers and producers, people like Stephen Bochco and David E. Kelly, have filled their programs with crossovers and sly references to each other. But much of the time, crossovers are little more than a ratings stunt, a way for a network to promote one show at the expense of another. Larry Jones is general manager of TV Land, which periodically does whole evenings of crossovers and spinoffs.
After a show's been on a while, it's like, how do you get people in the third or fourth season? How do you get people to continue that excitement about the show? How do you keep people talking about it around the water cooler? He has another way, oh, look, they're doing this week. They're doing something else. It's something different.
But there may also be something fundamentally appealing to viewers about the notion that characters from different programs exist on the same existential plane. Jones says it goes to television's place in the American psyche.
We often talk about TV Land, not in the sense of like this cable channel, but TV Land in the generic form of like there's this place that exists out there where Donna Reed lives down the street from, you know, the Leave It to Beaver. You know, Joe Mannix is the guy you go to when, you know, you need an investigator. You kind of do think shows of a certain ilk, they probably did know each other. They probably did live down the block.
For Tom Holbrook, there's also a 6 degrees of separation kind of appeal to crossovers. A few years ago, he set out to list how many crossovers he could find. At first, he used charts. Then he set up his own website. After it was named Yahoo's Site of the Week, he heard about even more crossovers. Holbrook never lists a crossover on his site unless he can verify its accuracy. But there are hundreds of verifiable crossovers connecting dozens of programs to each other.
The end result is you can have shows utterly far removed from each other, connected in the same world, such as my prime example always is, you can connect the world of the sitcom MASH to the world of X-Files.
Holbrook says the character of B.J. Honeycutt on MASH was once mentioned as a medical school friend of one of the doctors on St. Elsewhere. The St. Elsewhere character of Roxanne, played by Alfre Woodard, appeared on an episode of Homicide. Then Homicide's Detective Munch turned up on The X-Files, interrogating a character.
Detective Munch, Baltimore Homicide.
Did they find her?
And a good evening to you. Sorry, no sign of your mystery lady.
She is real. The FBI agent saw her.
Yeah, well, Special Agent Mulder is currently being held in 5-point restraints and jabbering like a monkey.
Holbrook says he can connect Knight Rider to Star Trek, Touched by an Angel to Mannix, and Gomer Pyle to NYPD Blue. Sometimes the connection is subtle. The hospital on St. Elsewhere was taken over by the Weigert Medical Corporation, which was also the name of the company that ran the prison hospital on Oz. Both shows were written by Tom Fontana, who does a lot of crossovers. Holbrook says that at times the currents and cross-currents between different programs get positively mind-bending. For instance, he says, in the last episode of St. Elsewhere, the entire series was revealed as the dream of an autistic boy. But St. Elsewhere crossed over with a lot of other shows. Were they also part of the boy's dream, he asks? Complicating it all is the fact that one of St. Elsewhere's crossovers was the Bob Newhart show, in which the comic actor played a Chicago psychologist. It later had a very memorable crossover of its own with the actor's next sitcom called Newhart.
And the last episode of Newhart revealed that that entire series had been the dream of his character from the Bob Newhart show. So now you have a case where you have a young autistic boy not just dreaming an entire reality, he's also dreaming about a psychiatrist who dreamed an entire another universe.
And what of the fact that Newhart crossed over with shows of its own? Is the entire TV universe one of separate realities that overlap and double back on themselves in a way that makes quantum physics look simple? Holbrook says that may be the point at which you've probably carried crossover analysis a little too far. For On the Media, this is Jim Zaroli.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Tony Field, and Megan Ryan. Engineered by Rob Christensen, Dylan Keefe, George Edwards, and Neil Rausch. And edited by Brooke. We had help from Blake Carlton and Josh Keating. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.